Sorry. So I was tempted to borrow from Chet and his picture of Mike up on a mountaintop, because I don't have any such pictures, and then just photoshopping my face in. But in addition to changing the face picture, I would have had to thicken Chet up a bit to make it convincing. So I decided not to do that. Mike has been easy on me. We have gone on hikes, but I always carry a topo map, and I won't go anywhere with high elevations with Mike. My experience with Mike is an interesting one. I spent a lot of time as a mathematician and then stopped for a very long period of time. And it was amazing when I'd come down how much Mike would ask questions. And, he was a sort of a broad-minded topologist. He cared about infinite groups. And I often couldn't help him with any question he answered, but I would always go home and start working on some problem that I hadn't thought about in 15 or 20 years. My wife actually remarked when, I sort of was about to come down, I was kind of glum about something at work, and I'd come back, and she said, what the hell do you do there? You come back happy all the time. So she was somewhat suspicious, and I'm definitely not telling her about the Polynesian dancers. But I did want to thank Mike. It's everything everybody says has been true. It's, Mike is a little bit like the Cheshire Cat. The excitement lasts after the cat's gone, and it's a hard act to follow. So normally I would... when we're talking about Q, my opening line would be, it's not about quantum. It's not about cryptography. Quantum computing is important for lots more stuff. But this time, since I no longer have to play that role, I'm actually going to talk about cryptography. And it should be, it's a survey. It should be fairly general. It's what effect would quantum crypto have on everyday practicing cryptographers? So I want to set the stage. There have been a number of papers recently, some of which are a little bit irritating, and I'll tell you why they're irritating when I get to the third or fourth bullet. So I need to talk about the primitives people use when they do cryptography these days, public key systems, symmetric key systems, and hashes. I'll talk about the classical attacks, the attacks that don't work, that you don't need a quantum computer to have work, and then some quantum attacks, typically Shor's and Grover. And then I'll talk just a little bit about what the effects of quantum computing according to the conventional wisdom are. And it is slightly irritating. The conventional wisdom is, okay, listen, you're going to have to switch from factoring and discrete log-based public key systems to something like McLeese or Entru or something, some other system for public key use, and you'll have to double the symmetric key sizes and hashes. But other than that, the union is preserved. You'll have a job. Everything will be okay. In the course of writing this talk, actually, maybe as an example, I noticed something, and I talked to Mike, and I actually think there may be a little bit further investigation on one area which actually a quantum machine might help in cryptography that I haven't seen before. All right, so here's the setting. Some sender Alice has some plain text. She wants to send it over a phone line, some noisy channel, wireless computer network, anything. She has a key that she encrypts the data with. Some bad person, maybe a good person even, is eavesdropping on that channel. It goes to Bob, her intended recipient, who has another key, and he gets the plain text. And Alice wants to make sure the eavesdropper never sees her message, doesn't know what's happening. There are two variations of the scheme. The first one, the oldest one, is a symmetric key system where Alice and Bob get together in a room before any of this happens and share a key. That's a secret. They don't tell anybody else in the world. Sometimes couriers carry the keys, sometimes whatever. These are symmetric systems, and they're very fast. In fact, these days, there is no reason not to encrypt anything that goes over a wire, that video rate anything. For symmetric encryption, performance really is just not a problem. The second mechanism is the asymmetric systems, which have gotten more attention in the quantum computing world. In this case, the keys are asymmetric. There's a public key and a private key. And the public key is something, as long as it's authenticated and well known, you could tell anybody in the world, publish it in the New York Times. And your private key is the thing that you use to decrypt something. And if you publish the public key, it should be very hard to discover the private key as well to decrypt anything. So this is an asymmetric system, and it's quite useful for some historical problems. One is key distribution itself. Remember I said Alice and Bob had to get in the same room. As a practical matter, that's a pain. and many of the problems in crypto systems had to do with key distribution. Also, asymmetric public key systems let you sign things and authenticate things, which is not something a symmetric system typically does. Okay, so those are the mechanisms. There's one other mechanism which is very close to a symmetric cipher. It's a cryptographic hash, and it just has this property that when you apply it, if I have a message and apply the cryptographic hash to it, I get a number. If I just tell you the number and not the message, it should be basically impossible to get the pre-image to find out what the original message is. And it's used, there are harsher properties, but that's a simple one to understand. The basic idea is if I change the message at all, I'll get a different cryptographic hash. So if I tell you a hash of a valid message, I won't be able to later go back and lie about the message. That's mostly used in signature screens because, as you see from this little table, public key systems are much, 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 much slower than symmetric key systems. So typically, even when you sign a message, what you really do is take a cryptographic hash and decrypt in the public key setting, the hash to sign it. And that's very slow. But you only apply the public key system to a short hash as opposed to the latest speech by somebody. Symmetric key systems are much faster. These are, by the way, taken on a very, very old machine. They're a lot faster. And in fact, for the symmetric key systems, Intel has an instruction which is in newer machines which make them much, much faster. One interesting thing about RSA is you can note the great asymmetry in speed between encryption and decryption. Okay, so what do you use this for? Well, the probably thing most people use for it is SSL. When you go to your bank or when you go to Gmail or go to Hotmail, it opens an SSL session, which basically means it uses a public key system to authenticate the channel, whether it's Google or whoever, and then negotiate a symmetric key for the remainder of the session. In fact, two symmetric keys because it also does authentication. If you send an SMIME mail, what happens is your public key encrypts a symmetric key that you've made up. You encrypt the message with the symmetric key, and you put the sealed symmetric key, sealed with the public key of the intended recipient in the message. It goes off. They unseal the public key with their private key and decrypt the message. Encrypted media, legal agreements. I just bought a house. As an example of what goes wrong with cryptography, I think it was a digital signature system I used remotely, but they gave me my private key, which seemed defective. I don't quite understand what that was all about. So what are characteristics of a symmetric system? Well, here's a very simple symmetric system. It can't possibly be secure because it's tiny, 4-bit input, 4-bit output. And you can imagine what it does is it just permutes the inputs, the fully decoded inputs and outputs. So 4 bits inputs, there are 16 possible messages, and it permutes them. But even from this simple diagram, you can tell some characteristics of a symmetric key system. First, the key basically picks out a permutation in that S16, in this case, symmetric group. That's the purpose of the key. And you don't want a very simple transformation. And simple is what, not simple, defining it carefully is what makes symmetric systems hard to break. But obviously, it can't be too regular. Otherwise, an unintended recipient, given just a little corresponding plain and ciphertext, can break it. The entire science or art of making a symmetric key system is doing the stuff that makes that transformation hard to reverse if you don't know the key. So again, typical block size ciphers, maybe 64 bits. You can't make a cipher by pre-computing an enormous table and giving it to Bob. A table that big, you couldn't even store. On the other hand, you want something complicated. You want something that makes a transformation like that difficult to reverse. And the way it's done on a computer is to do simple transformations, but do them many times and make each of them key dependent. So for example, DES applies a very simple transformation 16 times. With slightly different keys derived from the original key. And the transformation is really pretty simple. Each round consists of two transformations. One is the trivial swapping of the two 32-bit quantities, and one is taking a nonlinear function f, which we're going to pay some attention to, and XORing the key plus the expanded right-hand side of the word to the left-hand side. So it only changed the left-hand side of the word. And it's so the DES is made up of nothing but those involutions, those order two transformations. And notice them, each of their own inverse, switching and switching back invert. And if you apply this very simple transformation twice, you XOR out the thing you XORed in. The way it's actually constructed in DES is you take that right-hand side, expand it to 48 bits by just repeating some bits, take 48 bits of the key, XOR that in, and apply 8 6-bit to 4-bit transformations, and finally permute the outputs. And those S boxes are the things that make the transformation hard to invert. They're nonlinear. Again, as an example of how one way in which they have to be complicated, this is a this is the expression of those each bit position as a polynomial in those six variables. They're complicated. They have a lot of terms. They're fairly high degree. Cryptographic hashes, I'm not going to say too much about, except you can construct them from block ciphers. So if you can break a block cipher, you can break a cryptographic hash. The techniques are very similar. Okay, so how do people break symmetric key systems? There are really three basic things. They do exhaustive search on the key space, and then there are three other techniques, and I will focus on the second two, differential and linear cryptanalysis, and then algebraic cryptanalysis, which actually depends on the algebraic representation. On DES, exhaustive search takes 2 to the 55th because there's an internal symmetry. And the best attack is linear cryptanalysis. And that might not sound much better, but 2 to the 43 is a lot smaller number in the real world than 2 to the 55. DES actually, in the end, was a pretty good cipher. Differential cryptanalysis, what you basically do is take a fixed differential between the input and output and track it through. And what roughly happens is, since these S-boxes are nonlinear, the distribution of those differences actually change for different inputs and outputs. In the particular case where I would show you an example, is 3/8 of the time a particular differential input produces a particular differential output. It turns out when you XOR that message input, that will convert into a vote for a key. 5/8 of the time, the key vote will get scattered all over, but 3/8 of the time, it will concentrate on the key you're looking for. And that's how you do differential cryptanalysis. Linear cryptanalysis is another sort of simple idea. Suppose you could find a function that you applied to the plain text, the input, and the ciphertext in the output. And it turned out you had a linear function of the key bits. All these are over GF2. Well, you had enough of those, you could solve for the key bits. It would take very little time. So good ciphers don't have linear constraints. But what they often do have is an almost linear constraint, that you can apply a function to the plain text and the ciphertext and get a linear function of the key bits, which holds not with probability 1/2. Either with probability slightly more than 1/2 or slightly less than 1/2. And it turns out either is okay. That difference is called a bias. And if you can find a relation like this with a bias of epsilon, you can break the cipher with 1 over epsilon squared of work. So the better a bias you find, the easier it is to break. You can construct these round by round. Again, typically the way you construct them is by hand. You look at each individual S-box and you find the best linear approximation by hand. I realize this is flying very quickly, but you can take several, these single round equations, add them, and end up getting a relationship like this, which is exactly the kind of relationship you want. This has some function of the key bits, key bit 17 of the right-hand word of plain text, 3, 8, 14, and 25 of the plain text. If you XOR that with those named ciphertext bits, they will always be, with probability 0.6, have that function of those key bits. Again, so now you can solve for the key bits with enough text. Unfortunately, it's hard to find these, and the way they're constructed in real ciphers like DES is S-box by S-box, 6-bit transformation to 4-bit transformation. And that's actually critical. You can't do complicated ones because it's hard to find all the linear approximations if n is big, if the number of input bits are big. Here's how you do find it. It will start to sound familiar. If you look at that function, that Hadamard transform, suppose W is an n-bit value, and you calculate this quantity, the sum over all the x's of minus 1 of f of x, x or W, it's kind of like a dot product with x. So it's the linear function in x where the bits used are correspond to the W position. Well, if the A is the number of values for which f of x agrees with the linear function, and D is the ones for it disagree, by looking at that, actually you can find out that the probability the linear function is the same as the nonlinear function is A over 2 to the n, which is 1 half of 1 plus that Hadamard transform. And in fact, here's the Hadamard transform for one of the S boxes I put up. And those are those two red, and I guess orange, are the two best linear linear approximations to that to the sum of those four output bits of the S box. By the way, if you take the square of all these values, this is a probability distribution. It's basically Parseval's theorem.
Those two are equally good.
No. I may have confused you. I said, remember, 1 half plus f of w, you care about the absolute value of f of w in this case. If you go back and do the f, then write whether it was negative or positive. 1 minus the probability would, anyway. So those are two. And sort of something interesting to notice here, if you square those, how much of the actual full probability distribution of that S-box is it? It's more than half. So you would likely find those if you look down the most likely ones. Okay. Public key systems, I'm really going to race through this. There are three really basically in use, RSA, El-Gamal, which is a discrete log-based problem, and elliptic curve systems. I'm assuming you're going to know RSA. In fact, how much time do I have? About 15?
A little more than 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. So RSA, then I will talk about RSA just a bit. Basically, the idea of RSA is Alice, the private key holder, gets two primes, P and Q. She publishes N, their product, but doesn't tell anybody what P and Q are. So Bob, to encrypt the message, just raises his message to some power, some predetermined power, and takes it mod N. I won't go through the details, but you need to know the P and Q in order to decrypt the message. And it's basically related to finding to find the message. To break such a system, I won't give you the example, but the classic way to break such a system is to factor N. And there's a very old technique I saw in a game book in the 1930s, and the technique is to try to find x's and y's such that x squared equals y squared mod n. And not in a trivial way, because if y is x plus n, x squared equals y squared. But if you pick them in an honest way, with high probability, p will be in one of those and q will be in the other one. So if you take the GCD of either x minus y or x plus y with n, which is, again, computationally easy, you will find out the p to the q, and now you'll have Alice's private key. The trouble is, it's typically hard to find those X's and Y's in an honest way. There's some randomized techniques to do that. These are the four methods people use to find such X squareds and Y squareds. And they all take a pretty long time in the number of bits in the key. And that's what makes the system secure, in principle. The second public key system is based on this hard problem, and that is discrete log. So if you have a group, and I have an A, which I keep secret, and I compute G to the A and hand you that result and say, what's A? It's hard for you to reverse that computation. You typically cannot find A. And so the algamalysis, so crypto systems use that fact to encrypt the message. You find a P, a prime, which is going to be the where the multiplicative group lives. You pick an A, which you keep secret. You publish A, which is equal G to the little a. That's the public key. If you want to, a person with that public key can encrypt the message by picking another random B and sending this value here, G to the B, and his message times A to the B. And it's probably hard to follow quickly, but if you know A, you can now find B, M. The valid private key holder can break the message that way. I won't go through the example. Algamal is typically broken with another technique called index calculus, which just solves a bunch of equations to find the discrete log. More abstractly, one of these discrete logs can be posed in any finite group context. I give you a y in a group that's equal g to the n, and I say find n. I don't tell you what it is. That's often computationally hard. And the final discrete log problem is the elliptic curve one. The most recent system is to take the additive group that comes from an elliptic curve. And again, I know it goes by very fast, but it turns out that there's a well-defined addition on points in these curves. And over a finite field, you can construct a group. Now, elliptic curves have some benefit. Aside from being full employment act for number theorists, index calculus attacks don't work in elliptic curves. And so for the same number of key bits, you'll notice the elliptic curve systems are much better than the RSA-based key systems. Or said another word, if you want to protect a symmetric key of 128 bits with the same level of security, you have to use a 3,000-bit RSA key, but only a 256-bit ECC key. And as a result, they're more efficient. Okay, I'm not going to go through the system. The final system is MacLeese's system, and this is very different from any of the systems I talked about in the past. In the MacLeese's system, you have a very particular, very large error-correcting code, and the private key is roughly how to decode it, how to apply the error correction. So to encrypt the message, you take a message and you add a bunch of noise, a lot of noise. Only the private key holder can get rid of the noise. That's the basis of the MacLeese system. Unfortunately, the disadvantage of the MacLeese systems is the keys are enormous, like 50,000 bits, much, much bigger than any other system. Okay, so let's go through that. So quantum attacks. The two standard mechanisms are Shor's algorithm, and that really clobbers all the discrete log and factoring systems. You can basically break them in as long as it would take to use them. And then Grover search, the search problem, affects symmetric systems. So in the normal exhaustive search of a symmetric thing, if you have 2 to the n keys, one way to break the system is to take a particular pair, x goes into y by the cipher, encrypt it with all possible keys, and then find out which one you get the correct values. And again, for 2 to the n keys, it takes about 2 to the n time to do that. But with Grover search, you cut the search time by a factor of square root. So instead of taking 2 to the n, it takes 2 to the n over 2. So Grover, if you double twice the key size, you get the same level of protection for symmetric systems. But up to now, that's all people did with symmetric systems. That's the best they could do with quantum computers. I won't do Shor's algorithm, as I said. Shor's algorithm works both, well, on all of these systems, and in 5 minutes I'll finish too. The first was the factoring system, where basically Shor's algorithm finds the period. And once you find the period, the n, such that a to the n equals 1 mod n, that's an even number, you look at a to the n over 2 plus 1 and a to the n of 2 minus 1, those are those x's and y's, where x squared plus y squared, and that's how you break the cipher. And that was the part that took a long time classically. But it doesn't take very much time on a quantum computer. There's a very similar mechanism for discrete log, although it uses one more register. So again, using very similar techniques, Shor's algorithm breaks the discrete log problem. Now, oddly, it does even worse on elliptic curve discrete logs. Remember, these were the ones that had higher security per bit. That was the reason they were used instead of regular discrete log problems. But they take about the same amount of time to break with Shor's algorithm, and they require fewer qubits. So discrete log-based problems are completely broken. I won't go through Grover's algorithm. So here we arrive at the conventional wisdom. So if you're a card-carrying, without allergies, crypto person, you say, big deal, quantum's not such a big deal. Stay away from factoring-based public key systems. Stay away from discrete log-based crypto systems. Use McLeese or something. By the way, these are the same guys who took 3 years to move from 160-bit hashes to 256-bit hashes. So might take them a little longer than... And double the symmetric key sizes, and everything will be fine. You don't need to learn anything new. So that's what most people think right now. Quantum computing has an acknowledged profound effect on public key systems. It has some, but usually minimized, effect on symmetric key systems. So this is a little bit irritating to have a group saying, yeah, forget it, you don't have to worry at all about quantum computing. It's not such a big deal. As I was constructing this thought, remember, we used the Waltz transform a while ago to find the best linear approximation to these nonlinear functions. In general, for n bits, computing the Waltz transform classically takes 2 to the n time. So if n is at all big, you can't really actually do it. But the thing I noticed is if you build a quantum computer that computes that thing, where U of f is the standard unitary transformation implementing the Boolean function f, it becomes that. If you measure y, you get a y as a measurement corresponding, hopefully, to something with high probability. And the thing with high probability is that coefficient, the Walsh transform. Again, the Walsh transform probability maps directly into the probability of the highest, the most effective linear equivalence. And so for this symmetric crypto system breaking technique, Hadamard actually provides an exponential speedup, a big speedup. It's Shor-like speedup rather than Grover-like speedup on finding these coefficients. Now, it's not completely trivial to apply this to this technique. You can find the best linear transformation, but don't forget these ciphers are done iteratively with different key rounds. And so you have to carve up the cipher in some way where you can apply this in a generic way. It's not like Shor's algorithm where it breaks the basic problem, period, and you're done with the cipher and that's that. It has to be applied intelligently. One application actually is for some of these ciphers is just verify that there's not a good linear combination, which you can in a big system. So the point is, I don't think it's quite as easy a thing as quantum computing will only affect your public key ciphers, and we've nearly got it under control. This is an example of what often happens in cryptanalysis, is you often don't break a crypto system by attacking the general problem and completely destroying it. It's you take some subproblem that has to do with the implementation, find a weakness in that, in this case the linear approximations, and then using that. And I actually think as we do more, we'll find more techniques like this. As I said, I was surprised not to have found this in the literature, because this seems like a valuable thing, and it seems like something that's relatively easy to compute on a quantum machine. By the way, I just found y for a single f, for a single Boolean function. You could add another register which was basically take all possible linear combinations of the block cipher output. So you would find the best linear approximation for any linear combination of the block cipher. And remember, that's what we used to find the best linear cryptanalysis of DES. So in fact, that's a one-step quantum computing thing as opposed to the rest of your life. So I realized that was very quick. I think the moral is there's still quite a bit more that quantum computers can do for cryptography. And since I'm interested in symmetric key cryptography, I often wanted a Shor's algorithm instead of a Grover algorithm to break something. And I think actually there may be some progress on that. So. Yo.
John,
no infinite groups.
What's that?
No infinite groups.
No, it's like the Wallstrom form, that's the Fourier transform over Z.
Yes, but that's right.
So shouldn't that be n log n time rather than, you said something about exponential time
classically? Yeah, you're right. And then I took it back immediately after I said it. Just much faster is all I care about.
But the point here is that even n log n is not fast enough for the implementation of the subroutine of finding the good linear approximation?
No, it is good enough. Actually, it depends what the n is you're talking about.
Yep.
So I think actually the n is not the 2 to the n. It's the little n. You can find it fast enough for 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 bit Boolean functions.
Let's see. The time to do the Fourier transform should be the...
it's as long as to do that Boolean circuit. But the n is not 2... The n, you see where the h is, the tensor with the n on top?
Right.
That n is not 2 to the n, the size of the block cipher. It's the number of bits in the cipher. So that's already log.
Right. I see. So in terms of that little n, I think then what you said is correct.
Yes.
N times 2 to the little n.
Yes.
Is the classical time to do that operation.
That's right. And it's not.
I see. Yeah. So it is worth...
So really, you can do this computation quickly on a quantum computer.
Yes, but not on a classical
computer. But absolutely not on a classical computer. Yes?
I think I have to wait for the microphone. My question is actually more sociological than technical. Unless we build a quantum computer, why should anybody worry about quantum cryptography? Intellectually, you can worry about anything. We worry about 26 dimensions and many different things.
Several answers. The non-utilitarian Mike answer is, well, why do you think about quantum computing generally or quantum mechanics until you have an answer? Okay, but the second answer is if you think it's close to being true, if possible, it takes a long time to adjust with these systems. As I said, the systems that have just been replaced took like 4, 5, 6 years to replace, and cryptography is basically the only security mechanism in the internet. If you don't have cryptography, I don't know what you do.
Okay, so, or if you're sending a message now that you want no one to read for 100 years. Okay, so if a quantum computer, that's just...
So you come along with a quantum computer, and even for a few hundred bits with this thing, you've caused people misery.
I think you are saying that if a quantum computer is not built, there is really no practical reason to worry about quantum.
Not for cryptographers, anyway. In fact, a lot of them would be happy. Is if there isn't going to be.
Absolutely convinced that quantum computers won't be built in the next 60 years.
Yeah, that's
it. If you want to secure messages.
Okay, I don't disagree with that.
But you physicists are so utilitarian. You know, can't you just...
Okay, any other questions?
Thanks.